fingers crossed we don't get bombarded.
Just let them at the drinks counter.
Oh yeah,
let them
have the plan. That's what
a little short.
I just took out all the alcohol bottles and left them positioned on the
help
oh
yourself.
Yeah, it's just I felt weird.
Put a helmet on them and BMX bike elbow pads and give them a bottle of vodka and a bag of jelly beans.
Oh,
see what happens.
Childhood in the 90s, 80s, eh?
Oh my god.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host, Will. Do you know what happened there? My phone interrupted me. My fucking phone interrupted me.
Oh, you're God. Such a professional.
Oh my God, my phone interrupted me.
He's joined once again by his co-host of One and a Bit Films and Three and a Bit Episodes of TV, Kevin.
Hello, Kevin. How are you getting on?
I'm grand, Will. How are you?
I'm amazed. But Kevin, hey, it's not just us this week. Because I got best hand-drawn or 2D animated scene, I felt I kind of was...
Fixed.
Well, listen, there's a what's the word? Look, just people looking into it, and my lawyers know all about the situation. So, but I
saw that wheel. There was just one category going around and around and around.
It was just blue, a constant blue. But I'm delighted to introduce our very special co-host and guest this week, director of Three and a Bit Animated Features. Not only that, but he's also a producer, a writer, and co-owner of one of the best animation studios in the world, Tom Da Bomb Moore.
Tom. Thanks. Definitely one of the two best studios in the parish.
Down in
Tom Da Bomb. That's going to be your official credit in the show notes.
Yeah, Tom Da Bomb. Yeah, it's a little bit like my old secondary school nickname, Ace. They used to call me Ace.
No way.
They didn't.
All right.
I just like to pretend my nickname was Ace.
I was Maverick.
To be fair, Ace does sound like one of those self-titled
nicknames.
Yeah, it's
a very self-applied.
Hey guys, I'm not William anymore. I'm Slash. I'm Scar.
Jason Ironblood. Yeah.
Kevin, did you have any nicknames growing up?
No, as I said, but on Grabbers, I got the nickname Langers. And that was just what everybody started calling me. They didn't even know what my first name was. It was like, where's Langers? He's over there. I was like, I'm not going to respond to this anymore. You guys don't know what you're saying.
I was so entertained in biology class. I used to make up little characters in my copybooks. And after Edward Scissorhands came out, we were studying about the islets of Langerhans in the human body. And so I created a little cork-based Edward Scissorhands parody with Langerhans.
Oh, brilliant. I love that. And I think you should go to Disney and pitch it.
Yeah.
And,
the islands of Langerhans.
Gosh. You've sure been busy helping me and my pals.
The reason we have Tom in, as I've already said, is because I got best 2D hand-drawn animated scene. And it's one of those topics that is very, very broad. It's kind of like when I got best World War II scene. I was like going, Christ, how do you tackle this? And I think there's no way of kind of getting into it and try without coming across as another film history or TED Talk episode. And I think you kind of have to go at very subjectively. Or that's how I...
This is what Will says when he's not done any research.
Shut up, Kevin.
Well, it's worth saying, though, that animation and even hand-drawn animation is such a broad... It's like saying the best film.
Exactly.
Because it's a medium in itself. Like, there's no... it's not a genre, so it's very hard. It doesn't narrow it down
Jaws.
A lot. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Well, it's not, but yeah, that's the first. I did say, I said, can we just like qualify this some way and say best whatever whatever genre film? But no, I was outvoted in this podbot, yeah. And Kevin voted against me and said no, we're going with best hand drawn animated movie.
Yeah.
But really, I'm going to forego the fact that I didn't do any research for this, and I'm going to lean into Tom Moore. That's my plan. And I want to know all about Tom Moore.
You're
going to
lean more into Tom Moore.
I'm going to lean more into Tom Moore's experience and his career and figure
just
out.
Piggybacking on my nerdiness all the way to the Oscars.
Well, it's worked for me so far. I give up now.
Hi, Tom. I'm a writer as well. You know, I'm available.
Who's this? Or somebody else? What's this? I thought it was just you and me. Can we get him removed?
Does it? Hang on a second. I can't. Podbot. Boot
no,
Kevin.
Everyone's ganging up on me. Fuck this.
Oh, sorry, Kevin.
Can I ask you sort of a very basic question, but it's one that, you know, when I think about myself and the films that sort of inspired me, I'm wondering, what was the first animated film for you that you sort of were enchanted by or fascinated by, set you off on this path? Because I assume there has to be one that or a few that did that.
Yeah, that was something that came to mind fairly quickly when Will was saying it to me last week when I was in the house, because like I remember going to Snow White and being afraid of the witch, and my dad telling me that I could just look at the projector, and in the projector you could see her, but she was much smaller, so I could kind of handle her in the projector. So when the queen or the witch came on, I just looked at her small and then looked back at Snow White. That's a powerful memory, because I still can use that trick to this day. Whenever I'm a bit too scared, I can look up.
Oh wow.
It's a little bit easier to handle. I also really remember going to see a re-release of the Aristocats, I think, but they're vague memories. And you know the way sometimes they're a memory of a memory that you were told you remember, you know, like, so the one that made a big impression on me was at a birthday party when I was a kid, and I guess it was around maybe 87 88, and I was a bit too old, and I was with the older boys, and the fella that was his birthday had
a
little sister.
I'm still not sure about that.
Siri's talking to me.
Fuck
sorry,
off, Podbot. It's Podbot's evil twin sister.
It's a pod, it's Siri on my watch, my Apple Watch. But what was I saying? Oh, yeah, so they put on a cartoon for the little girls, and I ended up sitting down in trance by it. It was The Secret of Nim.
Aurora and Don Bluth Productions present a classic adventure in motion picture entertainment.
I must tell you about Nim. Look there.
It's a fantasy with wizards and villains. And heroes.
I ain't scared of nothing. I'm not even afraid of the great owl.
Will you hush up? Come on.
Which I looked at a bit of again earlier, and the one that really bit that really stuck out in my mind, and I still remember that weird feeling where I was a bit uncomfortable by how visceral it was, but it was so amazing, was the great owl in The Secret of Nim when Mrs. Brisby goes down into that cobwebby dark kind of tree.
Hello, anybody home? Well, the place looks deserted. I guess we better get out of here.
Step inside my house.
And then the owl is there, and he's eating moths as he's talking to her, and he's kind of threatening and amazing and beautifully done. And they did these glowy eyes that they would have had a little bit of transparency in a cell with a gel, and they would have put a camera, a light behind the cell, and it would shine through it and give these glowing eyes, which, pre-CGI was a credible, like, little extra you know, his eyes were kind of flashing and glowing as he spoke and all. Wow. So it really stuck out in my head. And I remember turning around and some of my friends who were, I suppose we were 8 or 9, they were looking in going, ha, he's watching cartoons. And I didn't care. I was way more interested in the cartoons and whatever they were up to. So.
That's amazing. So hold on a second. Yeah. So that was, no, first of all, that scene, right? It's a spooky, that's a spooky film. That's from stable of the 1980s. Hang on a second. Is this a bit
questionable
too,
for kids?
Questionable for kids sort of film. And it came out in 1982, I'm pretty sure. And
well done, but I had no idea of its existence until VHS, you know what I mean? So it was many years later. When it came out in 82, I would have been like 4 years old, so definitely the wrong age for it. And maybe a bit old for it when I saw it at 9 or 10 or whatever I was in 87, 88. But definitely it shaped, I've talked to you about this before, Will, it shaped my idea of what an animated feature could be in terms of tone. That's quite different than the prevailing trend of kind of glitter and humor and Dago colors. Back then there was real kind of mystic kind of darkness, like Dark Crystal and Jim Henson movies and Secret of Nim, The Black Cauldron, almost Watership forgotten Down. But Watership Down, those were the movies I grew up on, and they made a big impression on me, and they definitely had a lot of heft to them in terms of tone. And they were heavy and shadowy and kind of interesting, you know.
We came out in that era. That's the era we came out in. And there was just the kind of the shackles. There was just darker stories being told in that decade, which was kind of different to stuff that came out in the preceding decades, which is really unusual. But I also, this is what, now there's a serendipity to this. First of all, there's two threads I want to pull on that. First of all, the owl, which is like, you know, do you think that owl then became an influence in Song of the Sea and Song of the Sea?
Of course. Yeah, sure. I mean, like the big influences in my life, I suppose, were more things like the Ghibli films and Richard Williams' work. That was the stuff I was conscious of as a student.
Yeah.
But that primal, childish, you know, sort of engrossed in something and classical animation, I hadn't, like, when I talk about the Aristocats or the Robin Hood or any of those, they weren't as lush and luxurious as Secret of Nim. Maybe Pinocchio and Snow White were the closest things I'd seen to that, but it was so immersive and so spooky and scary. And you were down in the world. What I loved about it was the scale of it.
Yeah.
A lot of Bluth's early movies played with scale a lot. Everything looked like mad and different because you were down so small. And so definitely, when I was watching it again this morning to remind myself, I was thinking, oh yeah, that definitely crept into Mocha, all right, the Owl Witch. Yeah. Right.
The Owl Witch from the stories?
Well, no. Those stories always paint me as the bad one. But I'm not so terrible, you know. I'm just trying to help everyone.
And then there's a mad thing, because people listening might know who Don Bluth was, who directed it. So Don Bluth was a Disney guy, isn't that right? He was an American animator from the Disney studio. But he came over to Ireland. When did he come over to Ireland?
So I think he came to Ireland 86 or 87, and I had no idea that when I saw Secret of Nim that was Don Bluth. I was too young to make that connection, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember the Don Bluth studio coming to Ireland because in Kilkenny Castle, they screened An American Tale and The Land Before Time.
Yeah.
And they invited, I can't remember how I ended up there. Maybe
which he also directed, I suppose.
Yeah, Don Bluth. The Don Bluth studio made a few really cracker dark kids movies like that early on, and they moved over around the time they were making, I think, American Tale with Steven Spielberg, and they had people dressed up as the characters, and there was a certain amount of excitement. I don't know why, for me, the idea that this studio was in Kilkenny, or was in Ireland, in Dublin. I mean, I was down in Kilkenny, and then in Kilkenny Castle, they had the characters dressed up and went in. It felt like, oh, like Disney's coming here or something, like Disneyland was going to. And there was all sorts of stuff, like neighbours would have a friend of a friend who was working in the studio. And there was it was big news that he had a studio in Dublin. So I think that was part of what made me feel might be possible to be an animator in Ireland, you know?
That's amazing. You see, that's amazing. Yeah. Like, that's the germ of that. Like, in the Ireland I grew up in, it was like Harlan or priesthood or, you know, get a job in the bank. And it was zero. Like, I remember hearing about
fairy forts.
Fairy forts. Yeah, going up the fields and that's it. Like, you know, and hopefully they'll transport you someplace else. But there was, I remember hearing stuff about, like, you know, oh, you see that fellow over there? He operates a camera at GA matches for RT. And I thought, wow. I remember going, wow, people can get into the industry or there's a job in this stuff, like, you know. And I thought that was like magic, like, you know. So that's as close as I ever got to it, like, when I was young. But like to hear, I think, as a kind of like switching on a germ of possibility, I think seeing that, seeing those icons like in your town and hearing about people possibly working and making that stuff, do you think that like really was like a kind of a kickstart in your brain? Or
as a smaller child, yeah, because I really loved animation. I remember there was a movie program called Lights, Camera, Action.
Yeah, Leonard Nimoy. Season one.
Hello and welcome to Stand By, Lights, Camera, Action.
Yeah. Leonard Nimoy, I think, was like Spock. Yeah, and I loved Star Trek, too. So Leonard Nimoy was presenting it. And they, I guess RTE showed an episode around the time it was in the news that Don Bluth was coming in.
The animator behind The Secret of Nim is Don Bluth. Don worked for the Walt Disney Studio for almost 10 years. Then he and two partners set up shop in Don's garage. They were joined by 14 other Disney artists, all wanting to bring back classical animation techniques. Let's hear all about The Secret of Nim.
And I'd seen him on The Late Late Show. My parents had got me out of bed to see him on The Late Late Show, and he was drawing the characters from All Dogs Go to Heaven. And then this older Lights, Camera, Action was about the making of Secret of Nim. So I put it together. I went, oh, that's the same guy. That's that cartoon. Wow. And we didn't even have a VHS player at the time. So I remember the excitement of anything about animation coming on was based on the RTE guide and sitting up the TV early enough to watch it, you know. Yeah. And I made the connection with him then. And then I remember getting an idea that you made animation with like acetate cells on top of painted backgrounds. Yeah. And I remember begging my dad for them because he had like an overhead projector as part of his work as an engineer. Mm-hmm. And so he gave me, I had to wash the car on Saturdays to get this box of acetate cells. And I tried to make my own cartoon without a camera. I just had the backgrounds and the cells painted.
Wow.
So as a small kid, I was all about that.
It's just as you're saying that, I'm just wondering, were you interested in animated films because you could draw, or did animated films inspire you to draw? Like, what's the chicken and the egg there?
That's really hard to know. Like, the earliest known photo of my artwork, I'm 3 years old and I've drawn a dog for Popeye on a blackboard. And my parents think it's not a terribly great drawing of a dog, but my parents were doting and they decided they'd record it for posterity. So, like, somehow both were entangled for me. I loved drawing and I definitely was attracted to animation as a career because I wanted to do something that allowed me to draw a lot. They were definitely intertwined. And I was talking to Will there last week about this, that, you know, possibly it's great that people like Wes Anderson and so forth, Garth Jennings, are coming into animation who aren't first and foremost animation artists because they bring something else to the medium. But definitely in those ear days, like Don Bluth was the great drawer, like the really good animator of the Disney studio who broke away. And there was a kind of a cult around, you know, being a really good artist to be an animator. So they were very mixed up in my head, much more than being a filmmaker. I was older before I even thought of it as filmmaking, you know. It was in the same category in my head as like the characters on the cereal boxes and the comics and stuff that I'd read, you know.
I think that the art of animation is a very valuable heritage that's been given to the whole world. And that it actually enriches the lives of all the people all over the world, as it did mine when I was a child. And to see that lost, to see that even diminished, is a great loss. And I think it's worth defending, it's worth fighting for, it's worth keeping alive until there's someone else besides myself or all the other people that love animation so dearly can take a hold of it and make it grow more. And I, for one, am very, very thankful that there was a guy named Walt Disney, you know, and that he did want it to work like this. It helped my life. And what I'm hoping is that the films that we can make here will help some other people, too.
Was the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles rendered in Ireland?
Oh, yeah, it was animated here, too. Yeah, with Jimmy Murakami's studio.
Like an urban legend that all those kids used to show is that... You know, that show was actually made in Ireland. We're like, what?
Yeah. No, it was in the credits. I remember watching that. I was a bit older and I loved Batman the Animated Series. And they used to play the Teenage Mutant Ninja Hero Warrior Turtles just before it.
Yeah.
And so I'd end up catching the end of it. And I knew it was made in the Jimmy Murakami studio in Dublin. But I was older then, and a bit. I was in like first year of secondary school when that kind of happened. So
you're just
I was 11 or 12, yeah.
And it was the animation was. I remember distinctly it was a little bit rougher. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles,
yeah.
Side by side, even as a youngster, I knew the difference between Batman and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah. You're going, this is a little bit.
That
Batman was
animated
class.
Batman show is still the best iteration of Batman.
It's amazing
for me.
It's amazing. Yeah, I love the Teenage Turtles. I had friends who were certain that there were subtle differences between them. And when we got to college, one of our teachers had worked on it, and he went, "No, they're all the exact same design. We just painted the masks different colors."
My God. Oh,
different
my God.
Shades of green.
Yeah.
Kevin, I want to throw it out to you. Just a second. Did you have any kind of foundational or fundamental animated film that you loved growing up, or was the one that you remember as a kid?
It was all TV stuff. It used to be the Tom and Jerry cartoons. I would go around to my granddad's house, and he would have the volumes on cassette tape, and I would just watch all those. Which I suppose they were released theatrically in the 40s and 50s. The ones where he's playing the piano, and the one where they freeze the kitchen, and they were, you know, excellent.
They were class,
Yeah, and I watched them more recently a couple of years back, and they still hold up until you get to the 50s or 60s where there's a changeover in, I think, the creators of the shorts. But those were excellent. But, yeah, I loved Fantasia.
What you're going to see are the designs and pictures and stories, music inspired in the minds and imaginations of a group of artists.
I thought that was magical to watch.
It's quite highbrow.
It didn't feel like it was trying to make me laugh. It just felt like it was trying to take me someplace else. It was like really...
Oh, it's gorgeous, sort of
transportive and
a trip.
Yeah, just a... And in, along that line of thought, for me, when I was trying to think of what I could mention on this podcast, I was going back to Akira.
Neo Tokyo is about to explode.
Because for me, Akira was like, if you tried to make that movie as a live action, it would be $400-500 million to pull off because of the scale and the set pieces. And because it's not trying to, it just felt like a very adult cartoon.
I don't know
if that's a dirty word, saying the word cartoon. I was sort of coming into this thinking, is anime a dirty word? Is cartoon a dirty word?
God, cartoon wouldn't want to be a dirty word. It's the name of our studio, Cartoon Saloon.
I suppose that is.
But I think we like to reclaim it. I think we like to use it as a... No, but I don't think it should be a dirty word. I like cartoony cartoons, and it's ironic that our studio has made so many kind of earnest, you know, features whenever the name implies. But a little bit of, like... animation nerd fact for you about the Hanna-Barbera, the guys who did those original Tom and Jerry's, which of course were for adults. They were playing in front of, you know, Casablanca or whatever, they were part of that. And when they broke away, and it was almost them, even though they'd been doing these beautiful, fully animated, absolute, you know, we didn't see anything like it again until Roger Rabbit, really. That was full 1940s animation. They were the people that made all those cartoons we would have seen as kids, like Yogi Bear and, you know, Dick Dastardly and all that limited animation, very simple animation, because they tried to adapt for the TV. You know, they set up their own company for the TV. And so it's quite interesting to see that those guys were the absolute pinnacle of, they won Oscars and stuff for the animated short category. Used to be for your Mickey Mouse's or your Bugs Bunnies or your Tom and Jerry's, you know.
Yeah.
And they would have been big shots back then. And then they became kind of the kings of TV animation. But definitely, I think the idea that animation is for kids, or that cartoon might be a dirty word, I think comes from that 80s time when a lot of Western animation became really just to sell toys. You know, like every show was... an ad for toys, and they look back kind of with nostalgia, but they were pretty cynically made. And I think animation was in the doldrums, and and took Don Bluth kind of, whatever you say about him as a character, and I didn't know him personally, and I've heard all sorts of stories, but it took him saying, no, we can do stuff at the quality of the 1940s. We can do classical animation, and we should. And Spielberg kind of seeing the secret in him and backing him. That's kind of what brought animation back. Like, part of the animation renaissance, even in Disney, was the fact that Bluth broke away and was doing this virtuoso stuff in Dublin, you know? And kind of, in terms of Western animation. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like,
and then I suppose on the other side, you know, Disney were doing that and plowing that furrow of musical fairy tales. And at the same time, those of us in the 90s who saw something like Akira and kind of were opening our eyes to Japanese manga and Japanese anime, and we started to see, wow, look at what Ghibli have been doing. And, you know, look at this kind of whole industry and culture that respects animation as a medium, not a genre. And so those two things, I think, really collided into the world situation we have now, where animation is such a big part of the industry, you know.
Yeah, that's bad. Yeah. And you were talking about, because I suppose Akira was the one that broke into mainstream. It was the one that
everyone saw,
from my point of view, my experience was that I thought it was kind of like the first adult, and I didn't know there was a whole industry, because I was the only.
I saw it when I was a teenager, and it was sort of me too, as like, this is a badass animated film, and it was said sincerely, and I watched it and I thought, oh, I get it. Immediately, like, the tone that it set, where it was just it wasn't afraid to have moments of complete silence. It was just creating this atmosphere of absence in the audio, and beautifully drawn.
I remember with my bare knowledge of what it took to make some animation, from having done my own experiments and stuff, being blown away by like whole crowds being animated and explosions. And then, you know, I remember really noticing like a character trying to light a cigarette in the background, and I was like, wow, like in a Disney movie that would be the focus of the scene, but it was just a bit of throwaway character animation in the background. The scene was focusing on Tetsuo or something. And so I really remember Japanese animation at the time. And it kind of crashed into, on VHS tape, it crashed into us in the 90s. I would have been 13 or 14 by the time I think I saw Akira. And I was already a young Irish filmmaker. And there were some guys in filmmakers who were in film school. And so they were really kind of highbrow about animation when I talked to them about it. And they would get us VHS tapes of... There was quite a few. We saw Legend of the Overfiend, and we saw a lot of pretty hardcore Japanese animation. Before I discovered Ghibli, I thought Japanese animation was all like monsters and explosions and tentacles and things.
Yeah.
I love a good tentacle.
And I want to bring up another thing, Tom, because Kevin, you might notice, and our listeners might notice, but another thing that I always think is amazing in your story is the serendipity of this group that sprung up in Kilkenny called the Young Irish Filmmakers. And could you kind of explain to Kevin very briefly? And our listeners,
I know this. What,
you know about them, do you?
No,
you don't. Well, that's why I think it's, there you go. I think you were in such a unique time and place to have that experience. And what was it?
So many aspects of my story, when I look back on it, I just took for granted because I was a kid and you just accept what's around you. And I basically joined Young Irish Filmmakers, I think mostly to meet girls, you know, because there was girls up there and you went to an all-boys school. But it was a group. It was like a youth club after school. And if you weren't into hurling and you weren't into other stuff, this guy called Mike Kelly, he'd been a theatre director and he worked in TV in Australia, and he'd set it up as a kind of, a training ground for teenagers. And at the time, before smartphones and stuff, just getting your hands on a camera and an editing suite and being able to do stuff was massively empowering, you know. And we tried to make our own films, and we made a feature film based on Under the Hawthorn Tree. And Mike had to have friends like Mike.
How old were you when you did this? You made a feature film?
Yeah, but I didn't. I mean, I was like a production designer on it, but the group made it. Yeah, I think the director was Brona Murphy, who has like a flower shop in Dublin now. But there was a group of us in Kilkenny making stuff, and some of them were feature films. Every summer they'd made a feature film, and then the rest of the time was just mucking around on Saturdays, you know. And so that was kind of live action for me. Like, Mike would show movies and talk to us about movies. I remember watching Highlander to learn about match cuts and lore and stuff. And I remember Mike had a friend called Michael Adelson, who was a set photographer in movie sets and also a professor of film in New York, in New York University. I think he's still alive, Michael. And Michael Adelson would come over and give like all these spotty Kilkenny teenagers proper full-on film history lessons, you know. And because he knew that myself and Ross and a few of us were into animation, wow, he did a day on kind of like subtext, something that blew my mind. Like I was watching cartoons and loving them on one level. And he did a day on like how Roger Rabbit was speaking to racism in Hollywood, and how Toontown was kind of a stand-in for Coontown, and how they were seen as like disposable entertainment and all this kind of stuff, the black people. And it was a whole other level. It blew my mind.
You are blowing my mind, because I did not even read that into the film. I've seen that film so many times.
Uh-huh. And there's a bit where Donald Duck says the N-word. Like Donald Duck calls Daffy Duck the N-word. Yeah.
No,
if you listen
way.
Carefully, they're playing piano and he goes, low down southern N-word. That's what he calls Daffy.
Way.
Yeah.
I've worked with a lot of wise quackers, but you are despicable.
Gone, scamming.
Holy shit.
Jesus.
And so I was like 15 or 16 and I loved Roger Rabbit and was, you know, like everyone, had this weird feeling in my boxer shorts when Jessica Rabbit came on. I was like, this is a cartoon. What am I feeling here? But, and I remember watching that.
They knew exactly what they were doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was the start of I didn't realize how influenced I'd been by Richard Williams, who, like Don Bluth, was another one of these guys who saw the animation was falling into the doldrums and becoming kind of cheap entertainment on Saturday mornings for kids and had highbrow ideas for it. And Roger Rabbit was just a job to pay the bills for him because he was making his own art films and stuff and lots of commercials. But I kind of digress. Yeah, Young Irish Filmmakers at the time was eye-opening. I never went to film school and I was never really a film buff, but there was other people around me there who were and who were really into it. And people like Michael Adelson and Mike Kelly giving us those kind of lectures, like whether it was he'd do Buster Keaton, and he did a whole day on Buster Keaton. I really remember talking all about Silent and stuff that was really good for animation.
That's better
about
than
how
film
those,
school. It really is.
Yeah, how those guys would do like telegraphing what they were going to do because it was in black and white and they were wearing white gloves and you could kind of see where he was putting his hand before he put his hand in his pocket and taking out the keys. So it was all like staging, like really good quality staging for film, looking at silent movies. And then also the theory. We watched Beauty and the Beast, which had just come out in cinemas.
Yeah.
And or maybe it was just out in VHS, or we wouldn't have been able to show it to us. So we watched Beauty and the Beast, and we watched The Company of Wolves, and we watched La Belle et la Bête all in one day. And he was just talking about, you know, the subtext of fairy tales across all these movies. So it was really amazing. Yeah, it was a really amazing opportunity. Yeah.
What a gift to all of ye. And it kind of like, and that's what I think was so special about your that experience that ye had. The idea that films also was a community endeavor, that it's like no one person, you know, makes a film.
Oh, which
gotcha.
Is something
maybe that I got instilled in me, because my only portals into the film world were Empire Magazine or whatever, Dave Fanning. And
director does everything.
Think of the director of it, the
or the actors. You know, when you're really young and you just you don't even think about behind the camera. You just go, I want to be the guy I can see. Like you think he's making it, whether it's Harrison Ford or whoever.
It sounds daft, but I must have been 12 or 13 and I still didn't know that there were other jobs you could do other than act in it or direct it.
Yeah.
And it sort of was this epiphany for me where I thought, oh, I can write this stuff.
Yeah. I used to read the credits and see stuff like Gaffer and Best Boy and stuff and go, what are they?
I
remember, I really remember seeing art director, and I was in secondary school and it was like in my head, oh, maybe I'd like to be an art director. You know, it just seemed like something I might like to do. But because we had, because we filmmakers, we actually got a chance to do those things. Most of the time I was on clapperboard or something boring, but I was around the set and we were getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and meeting up on a Saturday, and there was camaraderie, you know, there was a sense that together we could do something bigger than any one of us could do. And I'd been mucking around trying to make cartoons of my own at home, and Ross, when I met him in secondary school, he was doing the same thing, and we were like kind of stuck, like the most we could do was whatever like the Amiga could do. But when we went into filmmakers, we were looking for the kit and equipment and maybe to meet girls, but actually we kind of learnt about working together as a team.
Girls, have a look at my flickbook of Jessica Rabbit drawings.
Yeah, exactly. Oh,
I marry her in this one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I did meet a producer once in London that gave a talk to a collective that I was part of when I first arrived in London, which was called The Viper's Nest. And that producer said to us, find your tribe and stick with them and you'll come up together. And that was his advice for success, was not to do it alone, find your tribe, stick with them, rise and fall with them, but that's how you will survive and succeed.
Yeah.
I never found my tribe.
I don't know. It's worth it. I mean, maybe you can find it virtually these days. You know, maybe people can. I often think kids who are online, like we were on the very early days of the internet back then, but what we had was just exactly that. And like Ross Stewart, who was a friend of mine from school and Young Irish Filmmakers, we co-directed Wolfwalkers together. He was the art director of Secret of Kells. And quite a few of us from that time.
That's Kismet, though.
Yeah. Kismet. What does that mean?
Yeah, what is Kismet?
It's like serendipity. It's just good fortune.
You were talking, you brought up Roger Rabbit. And Roger Rabbit, for me, was a big one where I just went, when I saw that, there was a clear, I remember something going off in my head as well, aside from the feeling in my boxer shirt. but there was a certain feeling of quality. This is the thing. It's like,
another level. Kind of like,
I haven't seen something like this before. And I would watch the opening short. I loved watching the opening animated short.
When the way he come close to the camera and away again. And the fact was that that's what Dick Williams had been making a kind of a living out of, being able to do all those kind of things pre-computer animation. He could animate in perspective, and he had trained the team using the old guys. Like, there was guys who'd been blacklisted after the Disney strike who were working in crappy TV animation, like Art Babbitt and Ken Harris, and he'd bring them over to his studio in London and was secretly kind of training the next generation from these kind of blacklisted ex-Disney and Warner Brothers animators, you know. So he was he kind of kept the light lit. And I think Roger Rabbit was the film that he was probably most noticed for, but he had done so many things that had influenced me that I didn't realize before I knew who he was. You know the opening credits to The Pink Panther? You know, it was really the class. I used to watch it.
As a kid,
and
I used to love that more than the film.
Exactly. I'd be like, oh, no, Peter Sellers. I wanted to see more of the cartoon.
Keep
you know?
The cartoon going.
And and so many commercials that that was him. So many commercials that we would have grown up on that were really, not as nicely animated commercials in the 80s. Yeah. And they'd be in between kind of badly animated cartoons. There'd be these like well animated commercials.
We did the Caramel Bunny.
Yeah, I think that was Dick Williams' studio.
No
might have been.
Way.
He had a way with those sexy drawings.
He really did.
You know, you ought to relax a while. Here, see how the thick Cadbury's milk chocolate melts into the dreamy caramel. I love birthdays, don't you?
But he was an amazing guy, and I only discovered who he was later in college, and I think that was the biggest turning point for me, because I was only in college really to get good at drawing so I could make comics, because I'd been to the Don Bluth studio and I'd seen what a kind of intensive process it was. And I'd kind of gotten addicted to being able to tell my own stories and tell different kinds of stories in Young Irish Filmmakers. Yeah. And I was a bit disillusioned by the Don Bluth studio, because they were kind of in the doldrums by then. They were kind of going downhill, and the people I met in there weren't terribly happy. So it wasn't the Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory we were expecting. And we came out a bit disillusioned, and we said, let's do comics, because we can. And at the time, comics were going through this really cool period where there was like Alan Moore and Frank Miller, and they were telling really gritty stories. And so I was kind of going, maybe we'll just go to animation school to be really good at drawing, and then we'll make our own comic, make our own film, our own stories that way. But it was when I saw a documentary on a tape that I took home from college about Dick Williams and about how he'd been trying to make The Thief and the Cobbler, and he was so passionate. And I realized, wow, he kind of talks about how animation could be an art form. And he says, hand-drawn animation hasn't done Rembrandt yet, but it could. And as an idealistic guy in my late teens, early 20s, that was really the thing that set. So I kind of say that the owl in The Secret of Nim, and then seeing the rough, unfinished version of The Thief and the Cobbler, and the documentary afterwards about Dick Williams trying to get hand-drawn animation back to the level, or even ahead of the level it had been back in the 40s. That's what really kind of lit my fire, you know.
Is The Thief and the Cobbler that amazing sequence that's floating around online? That feels a little bit like Aladdin.
Yeah, well, Aladdin is a total ripoff of The Thief and the Cobbler. This is real insider animation geek stuff now. Because what happened was, right, he had been trying to make that for 25 years on the back of commercials and the credits for the Pink Panther or whatever he was doing. And he was trying to show that hand-drawn animation could do something that had never been even attempted in Disney. He was going to the next level, you know. And he was kind of laboring away and putting all the money he was making out of commercials into this dream project. And the guys in ILM got a copy of a part of it. It was completely unfinished, but a part of it was finished. And it was this sequence in a war machine. And the camera was constantly moving. And this is pre-computer animation. So even just stuff moving in perspective was mind-blowing. But it was all beautifully animated, beautifully designed based on Persian miniatures. And all the guys like Dennis Murren and, you know, all the guys in ILM, they were like, what the hell is this? They were blown away by it. And it became kind of legendary amongst, you know, those type of people. People like Phil Tippett and, you know, like the animation people in ILM. And so then whenever Zemeckis...
Dinosaur wranglers,
yeah. And so the legend was that Spielberg was looking for someone to work with Zemeckis on Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And they were basically saying there was nobody left really who could do stuff to that level. And then they looked at that sequence from The Thief and the Cobbler that Richard Williams had been working on for so long. And they were like, let's get in touch with this guy. And so that's how he ended up being the animation director for Roger Rabbit. And on the back of Roger Rabbit, he was hoping to get the money to make The Thief and the Cobbler. And there's definitely a shared DNA in Aladdin. You can tell it. They're both based on the Persian, you know, Arabian Nights tales.
Yeah.
And there's definitely some pretty close to the bone stuff that animators who obviously worked on Who Framed Roger Rabbit had seen the
influence
Thief and the Cobbler and had been influenced. How much you could debate, but there's definitely a big...
And it had a really bittersweet, like not a bitter ending. Like, you know, the film was taken out of his hands. Mm. Was it by Harvey Weinstein or something like that? Or,
it was just kind of really dark. Yeah.
They threw it was supposed to be like, not like, you know, dialogue-less, not silent, but a dialogue-less film. Am I right in saying that?
And so the main characters were like, literally your Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin type pantomime characters. But the baddie was Vincent Price.
Wake, Father.
Oh, great King Nob, have no fear. Zigzag, your Grand Vizier is here.
That's right. That's what I've seen. I'm sure it's on YouTube. There's about 2 or 3 minutes of it.
Yeah, there's the recobbled cut. What happened was when they were taking it off him because he went so over budget, it was his baby and he'd lived with it for 30 years. There's a great documentary you can watch about it. And he kind of ended up becoming more famous afterwards as a teacher because he put everything he'd learned from the old guys into the Animator Survival Kit, which became the Bible for hand-drawn animation. But at that time, he'd been just going over budget and over schedule. He was so ambitious and such a perfectionist that eventually they took it off him. And just before they took the film off him and kind of butchered it, really, he did a work print. He did a quick work print of it. And then that has been restored by the Academy. And I was in the Academy a few years ago and they knew what a complete nerd I was for Dick Williams stuff. They brought me down to the basement and they have in their archive all the artwork. Because what happened was the Weinsteins bought it as part of Miramax to bury it, basically. They bought it and basically buried it. They took all the artwork, they took everything. And so there's literally lovingly preserved in the Academy archives all these boxes and boxes of stuff that was just discovered by somebody in the Miramax vaults or whatever when the Miramax was going down, you know. And so it's gorgeous. There's like production notes and sketches and huge paint, like epic stuff, like unbelievably huge stuff, like paintings as big as a room almost because the camera would pull out so far. And we're talking about physical artwork. So pre-digital, you literally did everything on sheets of glass so that the camera would seem to be moving through, you know, a multiplane camera. So he was doing stuff on another level and redefining what hand-drawn could be because it was all flat and playing with perspective and playing with optical illusions. And it was very 60s kind of Yellow Submarine trippy kind of imagery. And it really blew my mind because all the Disney stuff is so illustrative and trying, and even Bluth trying to be like a, you know, like a storybook kind of illustration, but he was trying, he was really pushing it into a pure kind of optical illusion art form. So yeah, anyway, sorry, I'm raving about Dick Williams.
The thing with The Thief that I'm just trying to do, what they call a masterpiece, when you master a medium, in the old days, if you were a master painter, then you did your masterpiece. Well, this is an old fashioned, I've mastered this medium at last, and I'm gonna do a masterpiece, I hope, if I can ever finish the thing.
What's driving you to produce this masterpiece?
Quest for excellence. It's not an obsession. I'm just a throwback to an old craftsman who wants to make a pot right or a painting right. I just saw Rembrandt I was up in, playing in the Edinburgh Festival, and when in the art gallery, there was a Rembrandt there that he did when he was first bankrupt. He was about 48 years old. That's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. He didn't do it for money. He had no reason to paint that amazing painting. He just wanted to do it. And that's what I'm saying. I just want to do something good.
And if he does get the £7 million he needs to do something good, he's still got to spend 3 more years and have a total of 3 million drawings completed before The Cobbler and the Thief hits the cinema screens.
I assume Ghibli is an influence. Was an influence on you at some stage as well?
Yeah, but not my earliest influence. Like in college, we all loved Princess Mononoke. That got a release and was dubbed, and that was a big deal for us. We were already in college and already really passionate, and I think Princess Mononoke was a further confirmation that animation could do more than singing fairy tales and you know, talking toys and stuff. So Princess Mononoke was a big thing.
In a time when gods walk the earth, an epic battle rages between the encroaching civilization of man and the gods of the forest.
When the forest has been cleared and the wolves wiped out, this place will be the richest land in the world.
Now, the fate of the world rests on the courage of one fearless princess.
I'm not afraid to die, and I would do anything to get the humans out of here.
And one brave warrior.
And then continuing my animation nerddom with VHS is how I discovered Totoro and Kiki.
Yeah.
And I remember the bus scene in Totoro, watching it with my son, and I felt kind of jealous that he was getting to see it as a small child, because I was watching it as a young adult, you know.
Imprinting on him.
Yeah, so I was delighted to discover them, but I came to them much later. That and the Hungarian folktales from the Keskemet studio, and the whole world of Eastern European animation and French
that
animation.
That stuff is really creepy.
Yeah, yeah, some amazing stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but it's just like, I just picture everybody in the freezing warehouses making that and just depressed, just thinking, the kids will enjoy this.
Okay, and Blackie. There's some beautiful stuff as well. So all that stuff, I suppose, I encountered after I'd become quite dedicated to what I was doing, and has continued to be a huge influence. I mean, as you know, Will, like Spirited Away and Totoro were like touchstones for us during Song of the Sea. And even Mononoke was like, we didn't want to get too close to that with Wolfwalkers because we knew we were in the same area, you know, and... Tale of Princess Kaguya.
Do live action films ever creep in as influences? Are there any sort of like where you think that vibe or that moment, even if it's documentaries or it's anything really, where you think, I'd love to capture that or I'd love to draw that?
Yeah. Well, I draw live action films too. I pause them and kind of reverse storyboard them. I haven't been doing it lately, but I used to do it all the time. Like Wes Anderson really stood out for me as somebody who was like almost like an illustrator or an animator, the way he composes movies.
They definitely feel almost like animated films. Mm-hmm.
So I would pause like The Royal Tenenbaums or The Life Aquatic and just draw it frame by frame. And like in terms of live action movies, like my guilty pleasure or my favorite live action movie is Rocky.
Excellent.
For us as kids, Sylvester Stallone was like Bugs Bunny. Like we'd watch anything he was in. Like it didn't matter. So we'd watch like, you know, Rambo or Over the Top or, you know, Demolition, whatever, as long as Stallone was in it. Cobra. Yeah. But then as a young man in Young Irish Filmmakers, I kind of realized that the first Rocky is actually a deadly film. And I felt...
It's great. So good.
I felt through my life at different times, I really related to Rocky. Like, there's been plenty of ups and downs in my journey. And I definitely felt kinship. And I've analyzed the movie as well. And it's actually a really beautifully constructed and acted and shot movie in its own, you know... Ignore all the sequels, but the original Rocky is a really beautiful film in a lot of ways.
Definitely.
Is there a moment from that original Rocky that you absolutely love? Is there a scene from the original Rocky that you
love so much of it? I can quote it to the cows come home.
It's a beautiful story, and I think there are some cracking sequels. As we were just saying on another podcast, it jumps the shark, but it manages to also pull back from that. So the Rocky Balboa one where he has his son.
Yeah,
that's a great movie. Yeah. And I thought Creed was great.
Creed was great. I think if I'd only ever seen the first Rocky or Creed. But in terms of sequences, there's a few.
They make me sob, those films.
I went to Philadelphia for my 40th birthday a few years ago to run the Rocky journey from the Italian market up the steps.
Yeah.
And there's areas there that they're still quite depressed, you know, and the movie captured that kind of feeling. And there's a scene where he's walking away and he's bouncing a ball and there's like a railing, and they've kind of made it that as the railing is kind of disappearing into the distance, he's getting smaller and he just seems like he's becoming smaller and smaller. It's always really touching. And then there's a moment where Paulie gets really... horrible to Adrian and she kicks him out and they throw the turkey out in the street, and then Rocky just comes and wraps a blanket around her. I think that's a really beautiful moment.
It is a beautiful relationship.
But maybe the most poignant one, I think, is when Mickey comes, and after being really kind of shit to Rocky because he thinks Rocky's wasting his life working as an enforcer for the mob, he comes and hears that Rocky's gotten this chance at a fight, and Mickey wants to be his mentor or his trainer, teacher again. And Rocky...
I'm going
to
get choked up just thinking about it again.
Yeah, Rocky kicks him out. Rocky kicks him out. And then he's like...
Talk about your prime.
What about my prime, Mick? At least you had a prime. I ain't had no prime. I ain't had nothing. Legs are going, everything is going. No one's getting them nothing. Guy comes up, offers me a fight. Big deal. Want to fight the fight? Yeah, I'll fight the big fight. I wouldn't want to fight that big fight. It was going to happen to me. I want to get that. I want to get that. And you want me ringside and see it? Do you? You want to help me out? Huh? Do you want to see me get my face kicked in? Legs ain't working. Nothing's working. They go on, fight the champ. Yeah, I'll fight him. My face kicked in.
And then we see from a really long shot, really far away, Mickey going down the street and then Rocky coming down the steps after him and catching up to him. It's so gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
It really is.
No idea if it's influenced my work or anything, but I just love it as a movie.
I suppose it's emotion. You want to capture emotion.
But no, that's absolutely gorgeous. It really is. But I want to ask you, Tom, because there's loads I want to cover, because I want to bring it up because you brought up Totoro, right? But you know what I watched at the weekend? I watched Grave of the Fireflies for the first time in 20 years.
Amazing, right?
The mad thing is that, Kevin, you might notice, but My Neighbor Totoro and Grave of the Fireflies were both made by Studio Ghibli. And both, they...
Oh, I know that.
But did you know that they released both films on the same fucking weekend? Just for the crack.
Really?
Just for the crack. Like, Jesus Christ. What? Like, as a business strategy... Well, as a business strategy, you think, we'll just put one up against the other and see which out competes. They were competing against each other,
I thought they played together, no? Did they play against each other?
Maybe they did play together.
I thought you could watch one and the other, and I thought they were always an odd couple,
What about a tonal shift? Like, Jesus Christ. Like, I was in bits at the weekend watching Grave of the Fireflies. But then they're kind of similar in their own way as well. The fact that the kids, they both feature kid protagonists with, parents who are not there. But my God, the world that they're experiencing is, so tonally, totally different. But again, it's the humanity. What I love about the Ghibli films, and actually the Takahata films, Isao Takahata, who made Grave of the Fireflies and
Kaguya Princess Kaguya.
Yeah. My neighbor told
Yamadas.
Yeah. I love that. He, I find, is the one who has the most humanity in his films. His films have capture a kind of I know, just that there's a real tenderness to the way he treats his characters, and
he is much more a writer than an animator, you know, like he could draw, but he wasn't the draftsman that Miyazaki was.
Right.
And I think he's a good example of, yeah, someone who's working in the animation medium and seeing everything it can do because he's not an animator per se, you know.
Wow. Because that was the funny thing. I was looking at I think of these films and I went, the only standout kind of like scene from Takahata's films compared to Miyazaki is in Kaguya, Princess Tale of Princess Kaguya, is the charcoal explosion moment, and that's absolutely amazing.
Big influence, yeah.
Oh man, we were actually in the same screening. We saw that in the same screening with Takahata himself, which was mad to think, like, you know. Over in Toronto, which is just crazy, like, you know.
I always say that was why we got really brave with Wolfwalkers visually, because it was like doing all these interviews in Toronto and Takahata was doing interviews at the same time, and we were both saying like, oh yeah, hand-drawn animation is an expressive medium, it can do things that live action can't do. But then when I saw what he was doing with Kaguya, I was like, oh my god, he's kicking my ass in terms of like how far he's pushing the medium, you know,
in his 80s. Jesus, amazing stuff. And if there's an amazing documentary that I actually saw that time in Toronto as well, if you've any interest in Studio Ghibli, is it the one, The Kingdom of Dreams
Kingdom
and Madness?
Kingdom of Dreams and Madness, yeah.
It's an amazing documentary. Have you heard of it, Kevin?
No. What's the one where there's a moment where an animator is presenting, I think, something for a video game to him in a conference room?
Oh, yeah. And they were using AI to animate. Oh, that's the Miyazaki, yeah.
Yeah, okay, sorry, Miyazaki.
Well, Miyazaki could be quite cruel, I imagine. He comes across as someone who is
He demolished that guy.
Doesn't take shit, yeah.
Yeah, it feels like...
they were using AI to kind of... It's like the AI is trying to figure out how to walk. And because we anthropomorph things very naturally, it looks kind of cruel at these, like... creatures are kind of lumbering like zombies or stuff like that, and he's just like, you have created an offense to nature or something like that.
Oh, Jesus.
It's crushing him, yeah.
It just gets enslaved for months and months on this thing. Oh my god. So Tom, do you have like a favorite animated scene that you just go, I adore that scene, and why?
I think that's really cruel, right? And I've spoken a lot about Nim and the Thief and the Cobbler, but I suppose the bus scene in Totoro is one that I would just show anyone, and you wouldn't need to have any interest whatsoever in animation. And I think it's a magical moment when the kids are waiting for the bus and the Totoro's there with them, and they're at night and they go look at the little shrine and it starts to rain. And
Matte ne.
I think that's a sequence, a hand-drawn animated sequence that does everything. You know, it has the magic of what's possible with the medium, and the craft is so beautiful, and the timing and pacing of it is so gorgeous and so well drawn. And yeah, I think that would be the one I'd have to pick now. Oh. Yeah, that you caught me on the hop. Yeah.
Good.
That would be my pick too. I think for me, again, it's the humanity. I love the humanity and the moments and the gestures where there's two girls are waiting for a bus to go, and this strange creature, Totoro, just joins the bus stop with her. But it's the humanity of sharing an umbrella. I don't know. There's a verisimilitude to it that, you know, you feel the space is real. And it's more, I think that's the beauty of kind of like amazing hand-drawn animated stuff, the stuff that Dick Williams did and the stuff that the Studio Ghibli's and the stuff that you're doing in Cartoon Saloon as well, is that you feel they're going to be timeless.
Yeah, that's the hope.
We're going to watch them in 100 years time and you're going to go, wow, that's still...
I wonder where we'll be.
Well, I hope my head's in a jar.
And I'd say for me, as I said about Akira, I'm with Miyazaki. It would probably be the big abomination at the end with Tetsuo turning into a big tentacle.
That's so cool.
Good.
So can I ask you, Tom?
I bet he loved it.
How was it? You know the little trail lights? You know the little kind of like, you know, brake trail lights they had on those in Akira? You know the way the motorbikes
used? Class.
How did they do that?
I guess they must have hand animated them and shot them on a lower exposure. Like they would have run the film through twice. Because that was all on cells. That wasn't computer effects. So I guess they would have had to hand draw those trails. And then shoot them twice, like shoot them with a mask and then shoot them again at low exposure. Yeah,
it's so cool. It creates a kind of a kinetic feel.
Amazing. Yeah,
it's also that holographic thing that in the ship, which is spiraling around, and it feels like it's
that movie is computer amazing. Generated. And it's, you know, the movie is kind of an odd story because it's a truncated version of a much longer manga that he drew and wrote. And those guys just blow my mind. Like he drew and wrote this really long, really complex, beautifully created comic and then made a movie of it. It's like, Jesus.
Dedication.
Wow. A lot of work. A lot of work.
Oh my God. That is amazing. Wow. Well, I am delighted. Wow. I am delighted that I put all my chips on Tom Moore to actually provide all the content and research for this episode. And Tom, you paid off. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to spin the wheel, am I? I always wanted to do something like this.
We've sent Tom the wheel. And he's going to.
Oh, it was mad when they were delivering it earlier. I was wondering where all the light bulbs went, but they had it all set up, and they left. It was COVID compliant, of course. They had masks on and all. And when they set it up, the neighbours were complaining a bit about all the lights and the noise of it and all. But it's here now. It was well worth the effort, guys. I'm going to spin it. Okay.
You're very welcome. There we go. Fucking hell.
That was a big spin.
Coming
off. It's going to be spinning for the next 2 minutes.
Round and round and round it goes. Where it led, nobody knows.
You tell us.
I sort of have a feeling.
Best night in the big city. Best one night in the big city scene.
Oh, wow. There we go.
That's amazing.
Good man, Tom. We're going to have to get repair people and fix what you did to the wheel there, Tom.
Well, I gave it a big spin, but I think the guys are, they're coming in to take it away now.
That was your winning streak moment.
Huey, Louie and Dewey. Thanks, lads.
So, Kevin, next week you have best one night in the big city.
That's right. But before we go, we should say, Tom, where can people find you online if they want to follow you? Or
better off not following me online. it's just better that I remain.
Can I also say that same goes for me?
Well, honestly, my Twitter is mostly animal rights and vegan ranting, and it's sprinkled with some animation information, but I'm on Twitter. And my Instagram, you can see a lot of my Instagram. Oh, God, what am I? You'll find me on Instagram.
Tom the Bomb. Look
Tom the
Bomb.
And Instagram. That's mostly just life drawing and stuff. Never meet your heroes. Don't be disappointed during this scene. I'm Tom9769 on Instagram, and I do post a lot of little behind the scenes
69.
Things.
Nice.
Yeah. 9769. And I post a lot of little, you can see some storyboards from the early days of Song of the Sea there, and you know, pictures of the studio back in the early 2000s.
When you were babies.
Yes, and plenty of nudie pictures of life drawn models. So there you go.
Hold on, sorry guys, sorry. I'm just getting checking out my Tom's Instagram. Oh, Jessica Rabbit Tom. You still have a take for Jessica.
She's not bad. She's just drawing.
Caramel bunny for me.
The caramel bunny. I wonder was that Dick Williams. That's a really good question.
But like Tom,
and you can follow us under at Best Bits Pod, and back next week.
Best Bits Podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lads' latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Play dumb and stupid.
Two fun guys.
So what's the story, Kevin? It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. You've got news. Tell us your news. Hello, everybody. This is Kevin, and I'm joined by Will, and this is Minibit 72, just in case we didn't say so. I wonder what theme tune I'll put at the beginning of this. I've recorded so many of them. I usually just take my pick when I go for the...
Right.
So I go for the egotistical one, or the epic one, or the 80s synthwave one, or the cowboy and western one. We'll see. Depends on the mood of this mini bit.
Okay. I'm looking forward to hearing which one it is. I'm curious because you said to me, you've got news.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, what fucking news do I have?
You nearly died during the week. That is pretty monumental.
There it is. There's me dying right there on mic. Yeah, I almost died. Yeah, I almost died.
Because of the Discord.
It was the Discord, yeah. It was the Discord's fault.
What happened? Tell me what happened.
Yeah.
Because we haven't actually spoken in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Since the Irish episode recording, we haven't been on mic together. Do you want to talk about this? We can cut it out if you don't want to.
I do want it to be at the front of, you know, the way we have this, you know, the tag.
We'll save that.
So I'll talk about it later. I'll talk about it later in the episode. You know, we can talk about something else, but I'm quite happy to put it later for our special people.
Okay. Well, listen, I saw these questions on TikTok during the last few weeks, and I thought, those are good questions. I'm going to make a note of them. I'm going to ask Will some of them. So I've got about five of them here. They're quite philosophical.
Okay.
And maybe if I ask you one as the teaser of this episode, and then we can pepper out the other one.
Right.
See how you get on.
Okay.
So give me from one to five, a number from one to five.
Let's go five. Let's go all five.
Question five. If you could, would you rather spend a day with your younger self or your older self? Take your time.
No.
It's live radio.
This is a Back to the Future question.
Right? Is it?
Am I talking to my older self and my older self going, hey kid, bet on the Sox?
Would you sooner meet up with your older self and get the wisdom of your older self to say to you what you probably need to hear now, which is get a shift on, get a wiggle on? Or would you sooner go back to your younger self and say, listen, that thing that you're worried about, or that thing that you don't do and you should have done, you know, give him a pointer or some sort of a steer. So it's whether you want
is
the steer
it going to work
or do you
out?
Want to give your younger self a steer. Forgetting about the ramifications and the consequences. Forget all the sort of the grandfather paradox. For those that don't know what the grandfather paradox is, go back to our time travel episode.
Yeah. All right. I think I'll go back to my younger self, right? And I'll say, you know, I'll ask my younger self, come here, what's the big worry? What are you worried about? And
you should know that.
But I'm
going
to ask,
remember what you're worried about.
But the specific thing, because I worry about so many things. You know, we all worry about various different things, you know, from, you know.
Losing your Spider-Man shoes.
Yes. I'm going to go, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because guess
what? Content.
Next week, you're going to have Batman. You're going to have Batman willies.
Also,
right?
In the future, there's a thing called a podcast. And you'll be able to tell people what happened to your Spider-Man shoes on the podcast.
Exactly. It's all the bad shit that's happening to you will be, it's filling you up and it will be good content. That's all it is. All that embarrassing stuff that you do is going to be all right as long as you don't be too much of a prick and just stay the course. That's kind of it.
I'd be the opposite.
No, I think I would have a nice little sit down.
You'd have what? A nice shit?
I'd have a nice sit down and a nice little chat with myself. That's what I would do. How would you do? You're saying you would do the opposite.
I'd do the opposite. I'd want to speak to my future self because I can enact whatever they tell me. So I can, you know, live in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know. I'd like foresight. Tell me what
is coming towards me or what I need to be aware of, and I will make the change now because I can. Going back to my younger self, I would just be unburdening my younger self. And then, I don't know, hoping that that would change the course of my life. But I'm very happy with my life. I think everything's turned out fantastic. So I wouldn't want to risk changing anything. So, yeah.
Honestly, that was my first thought as well. I was like, going, yeah, I want all the information my older self can give me. And but I was like, I'll go back and I'll kind of help my younger self out a little bit.
When you hit 65, your prostate is going to blow up like a basketball.
Yeah. I didn't want to talk to my older self because what if my oldest self is 37? You know, I only live, you know, another 2 years. Obviously by saying that I'm implying I'm 35 right now.
I was going to say, I was like getting confused there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said I needed to put some clarity on that one. I would be afraid for my older self to come back, and my older self come back, and I see the state of him, and I go, "Oh shit!" Just one look at my older self, I go, "Oh fuck no!"
Listen, I just had the camera angled wrong there when I turned on the webcam here, and that's already rattled me. I'm like, "Oh god!"
You should never have the camera pointed at your balls, Kevin. Never, ever, ever, ever.
That's how I make a living. $5.99 a month. Well, listen, that'll do as a teaser.
Yes, go on.
Thank you to everybody that's listened to the latest episode, which we haven't recorded yet, and I hope it was a good episode because I have no fucking clue what I'm going to talk about on that episode. But we've already done it now because you've heard us talking about it. But also, this might be one of the random episodes. So, this is the Patreon. We do the mini bits. Come along. They're great episodes. We're going to keep talking, though. See ya.
Fuck them. Yeah, fuck that.
Fuck that.
Bye.